superb work in condensed matter physics, which is now moving toward doing such experiments in space. On the Caltech campus, he serves as vice provost, a position that puts him in a central position on matters as diverse as the undergraduate curriculum and technology transfer. It would be surprising if you were to agree with all he presents. However, in opening the public debate on energy, by writing this book, and by giving such public lectures, he's performing an important service to the nation. David Goodstein.
Thank you, and good evening. The picture up here is the picture of the book you heard about. It's a book that I've written. By an astounding coincidence, it has exactly the same title as this talk tonight. And as you've heard, the enterprising people from the Caltech bookstore are going to make it possible for you to take home a copy of your very own after the lecture if you really want to. So let's start our discussion with some myths about energy. $2.40 a gallon is too much to pay for gasoline. In the book it says $2 a gallon, but I've had to bring it up to date. At $2.40 a gallon, that's roughly 60 cents a liter. That's we pay twice that much for bottled drinking water. Europeans who come here for the first time are usually astounded to find that gasoline is the cheapest liquid you can buy in the United States. Oil companies produce oil, or at least they say they produce oil. They talk about production, increasing production, decreasing production, and so on. In fact, no oil company has ever produced a drop of oil. The Earth and the Sun produce the oil over a period of hundreds of millions of years. The oil companies extract it and sell it. That's why it's so cheap. We must conserve energy. Anybody who's taken a course in physics knows that energy is conserved no matter what we do. It's one of the most basic It's one of the most basic laws of physics. That doesn't mean we don't have a problem. It just means we haven't been discussing it properly. When we run out of oil, the marketplace will take over and replace it with something else. That's the economist's argument. We will look at that argument very carefully in the course of this evening. There's enough fossil fuel in the ground to last for hundreds of years. Once again, we will look at that argument very carefully in the course of our discussion this evening. Nuclear energy is dangerous. Most technically trained people understand that nuclear energy is the safest and cleanest energy that we have, but nuclear energy in the form that we use it now is not going to save the situation, as we'll see. The greenhouse effect and global warming are bad. I will argue that without the greenhouse effect and global warming, we would not be alive. So let's start with a brief history of energy. In the 18th century, heat was thought to be a fluid called caloric, and it was a conserved fluid. That is, you couldn't create it or destroy it. It was a precise mathematical theory. If a certain body had a certain temperature, you could calculate how much caloric it had. If the two bodies together, you could predict with accuracy how much caloric would run from one into the other and what final temperature they would come to equilibrium at. Nevertheless, there were those who doubted. And one of them was an American named Ben Thompson, born in New Hampshire in 1753, fought on the wrong side in the Revolutionary War and wisely went into exile, and first in England and then in Bavaria, where the elector of Bavaria named him Count von Rumford. Rumford was the name of the town in New Hampshire that he had lived in. He had a storied career. He introduced the potato into the common diet. He invented a drip coffee maker and various other things. But the thing that we remember him best for was a scientific paper he wrote in which he pointed out that the boring out of cannon barrels seemed to create an awful lot of caloric or heat out of nothing, and that should not have been possible according to the caloric theory. He even made an attempt to determine how much mechanical action was equivalent to a given amount of heat, but he was not successful in that. During the ensuing half century, what we now call the law of conservation of energy was discovered at least 9 separate times. When something like that happens, the credit for making the discovery goes not to the first one to make it, but to the last one, because he discovered it so well that it never had to be discovered again. His name was James Prescott Joule, and in his most famous experiment, he had a brass paddle wheel, horizontal paddle wheel, in a container of water with an arrangement that allowed it to be turned by means of descending weights. He used 4-pound weights. Each one would descend 36 feet and be replaced immediately by another one to keep the wheel spinning. Finally, 16 weights would descend, and then he would use a sensitive thermometer to measure the change in the temperature of the water. He did three other different kinds of experiments. He repeated this experiment 9 separate times, averaged all the results, and he reported to the Royal Society of London that the amount of heat required to raise 1 pound of water by 1 degree Fahrenheit was equivalent to the amount of work required to lift 800 pounds through 1 foot. And that measurement constituted the discovery of the law of conservation of energy. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can be transferred from one body to another, and it can also exist in different forms. One form of energy is kinetic energy, the energy of motion. A bowling ball rolling down the alley or a car rolling down the road has kinetic energy simply by virtue of the fact that it's moving. But also the atoms and molecules that make up the car or the bowling ball are also always in random motion, jiggling around, bouncing off each other, and so on. And in fact, the absolute temperature of any body is directly proportional to the mean kinetic energy of all the random motions of its atoms and molecules, regardless of whether the body is solid, liquid, or gas. Then there's potential energy. Potential energy is basically the energy of position or relative position. So Joule's weights were being lifted up 36 feet above the ground, were being endowed with gravitational potential energy. There's also chemical potential energy, especially in the hydrocarbon fossil fuels that we'll be talking about a lot this evening, and you can release that energy by burning it. There's nuclear potential energy and so on. There's one other form of energy that's important to our story, and that is radiant energy. That's the form in which energy reaches us from the sun across 93 million miles of almost nothing at all. So here's a plot of the amount of energy as a function of the frequency in the electromagnetic spectrum that any body radiates. All bodies radiate energy all the time. But if a cool body, like your own body, for example, might have a curve that looks like this, with a maximum deep in the infrared, and then it falls down to zero before it reaches the visible. You don't glow in the dark because you're just too cool. A somewhat warmer body might have a curve that looks like this, with a peak higher in the infrared, and then it slopes down through the visible. The electromagnetic spectrum is radio waves at low frequency, infrared at higher frequency, a narrow band that our eyes are sensitive to, called the visible, and at higher frequencies, the ultraviolet, and beyond that, X-rays and gamma rays. This temperature body slopes down through the visible, highest at the red end, so it looks red to our eyes. That might be the temperature of an ember glowing in the fireplace. The surface of the sun has its maximum right at the visible. By no accident whatsoever, our eyes evolve to be most sensitive at the color of the surface of the sun. With that information, we can discuss the thermal behavior of the Sun-Earth system. Inside of the Sun, nuclear reactions heat the interior very hot. The surface is somewhat less hot, but still hot enough to radiate white light, according to the curve that you just saw, away in all directions. 93 million miles away, the tiny surface globe of the Earth intercepts some small fraction of that radiated energy. Of the energy that falls on the Earth, 30% is reflected directly back out into space, and 70% is absorbed. This is what the reflected part looks like. This is the Earth as seen from the Moon. That's reflected sunlight that you're seeing. The 70% that's absorbed has to be re-radiated back out into space. If that weren't true, the planet would either cool down or warm up until it is true, so it's self-regulating. It's a very simple calculation to figure out what temperature, the average surface temperature that the Earth has to have in order to radiate back into space the same amount of energy that it receives from the sun, and the answer to that problem is 0 degrees Fahrenheit. But if the mean surface temperature of the Earth was 0 degrees Fahrenheit, all of the oceans would freeze, the Earth would become much shinier, it would absorb much less of the sun's energy, and it would become much colder still. The Earth's climate is governed by a number of large factors. One of them is just the tilt in the Earth's axis. When the Earth is at position A here, the tilted axis points the northern hemisphere towards the sun, so it's somewhere in the north. 6 months later, it's in position C here. The Earth is a good gyroscope, so its axis always points in the same direction, but now the southern hemisphere is tilted towards the sun, and it's somewhere in the south. So the tilted axis creates the seasons. The El Niño cycle is due to some more or less stable wind currents that blow as a consequence of both the sun's light and the rotation of the Earth. And one of these is the so-called trade winds that blow across the equatorial Pacific from South America to Asia, scooping up sun-warmed surface water and piling it up against the Asian mainland, where it evaporates and causes the monsoon rains that are the characteristic climate of that part of the world. Once every 3 or 4 years, for reasons that nobody understands, the trade winds slacken, the warm water spreads back out across the Pacific, and there is drought in Asia and Australia, and great storms in North and South America, and huge perturbation of the whole world's climate system. The jet stream in the upper atmosphere is a consequence of the same behavior. The sun-warmed air at the equator rises and then splits off, going both north and south. The Earth spinning beneath it, spinning from east to west this way, beneath it, manages to carry along the wind close, the air close to the Earth pretty well, but does less well at carrying along the upper atmosphere. And so from the point of view of a person on the surface of the Earth, it looks like the upper atmosphere is blowing in the opposite direction to the Earth's rotation, from west to east. And that's the jet stream, and the precise behavior of the jet stream has a strong effect on our daily weather. Then there's a stable flow in the ocean called the thermohaline flow, thermal for temperature and haline for salt. The waters of the North Atlantic, the surface water, flows northward, and as it flows northward, it gets colder, and it also evaporates and gets saltier. Both effects, colder and saltier, make it denser, and at a certain point, a few hundred kilometers south of Greenland, it sinks. And that sinking drives a planetary conveyor belt. The water, the subsurface water in the Atlantic, goes all the way down to the tip of Africa and around it into the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. The water that sinks at this point will not emerge again for 1,000 years. It emerges out here and here and flows back along the surface. The Gulf Stream that warms Western North America and Northern Europe is an offshoot of this giant thermohaline flow. Of all of these effects, however, by far the most important is the greenhouse effect. We have, because we are 93 million miles from the sun, we have a certain flux of energy from the sun. This is averaged over the surface of the Earth, and over a full year, we receive 343 watts per square meter of energy. The Earth, and as I told you before, part of that is reflected and part is absorbed. The Earth's atmosphere is quite transparent to the white light from the sun, but when the Earth tries to re-radiate that same amount of energy back out into space, it's radiating it deep in the infrared, according to those the graph I showed you earlier. And in the infrared, there are gases in the atmosphere, trace gases in the atmosphere, that are opaque to the infrared, that absorb infrared radiation. Water vapor, methane, carbon dioxide, and others. They absorb the infrared radiation and then re-radiate it randomly in all directions. It re-radiates exactly the right amount back out into space. That's self-adjusting, as I explained before. But it also radiates a great deal of energy back down to the Earth. And the consequence is that in pre-industrial times, before we started tampering with the atmosphere, the mean surface temperature was not 0 degrees Fahrenheit, but a very comfortable 57 degrees Fahrenheit. And at that temperature, we evolved, climbed down from the trees, and started building steam engines. All of the discussion about global warming and the greenhouse effect has to do with changing this 88% pre-existing effect. And it can be very complicated. If you burn some fossil fuels and put some carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that increases the greenhouse effect. That makes the planet a little bit warmer. That causes more water to evaporate. But the water vapor itself is a powerful greenhouse gas, so that amplifies the effect of the carbon dioxide. On the other hand, the extra moisture in the atmosphere tends to condense into clouds, and clouds have a net cooling effect, so that works in the opposite direction. The warming of the planet shrinks the polar ice caps, and that makes the Earth less shiny, makes it absorb more energy, so that amplifies the effect. On the other hand, there are people who are afraid that the melting of the polar ice caps will freshen the northern waters, that is, they make them less salty, and could have the effect of reversing the thermohaline flow and actually lead to global cooling instead of global warming. So you see, the details are extremely complicated, and nobody can predict what's going to happen with any precision. We physicists are good at simplifying matters by looking at limiting cases. We've already heard one limiting case. If you stripped away all the greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, the temperature of the Earth would immediately drop to 0 degrees Fahrenheit, and then it would get much colder because the oceans would freeze. The Earth would be a frozen wasteland, and we would not be alive. The other extreme is to imagine increasing the 88% to 100%. We don't know exactly what would happen then, but we have a very good model to look at. The planet Venus is a little bit closer to the sun, so it should be a little bit warmer than the Earth, but that's a very weak effect. The physics would permit Venus to be very Earth-like in temperature, but we know that it isn't, because the Russians dropped a probe to the surface, and it found that Venus has a runaway greenhouse effect and a surface temperature hotter than molten lead. So this is a graph taken from an article in Nature magazine of the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in parts per million, the concentration of methane in the atmosphere in parts per billion, in the green curve here, and the surface temperature in red here, relative to some mean value, over the past 400,000 years, roughly the amount of time that Homo sapiens has walked the Earth. And you can see that the surface temperature of the Earth tracks the concentration of the greenhouse gases very, very well. What this graph cannot show you is what has happened in the past 100 years before the present. In the past 100 years, we have increased the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to 370 parts per million, and we've just about doubled the amount of methane in the atmosphere. So the fact that the Earth is 93 million miles from the Sun does not determine its destiny. As we've already seen, at the same position, it could be a frozen wasteland or it could be a Venusian inferno. Instead, what we have is a delicately balanced partial greenhouse effect that makes the planet ideal for creatures like us. And in burning fossil fuels and changing the greenhouse effect, we are doing an uncontrolled experiment with the climate of the only planet we have. We don't know where the tipping point is that would throw the planet into an entirely different state, one that might be hostile to life itself. It is a very dangerous and foolish thing to be doing. Okay, so where do we get our energy? Before 1800 was just 200 years ago. It's a blink of an eye on the scale of human history. Before 1800, the human race lived entirely on light as it arrived from the sun. The existence of coal was known, and some of it was burned for space heating, particularly in the last couple of centuries when trees started to get scarce in Europe. Oil was known because there are natural seepages of oil at the ground, but it wasn't used for anything much. There was something called swamp gas, which the Italian scientist Alessandro Volta analyzed to be methane, the principal component of natural gas. And so in some sense, the existence of what are now the primary fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, the existence was known, but they were not used. The Earth's legacy to us was not touched. Then, in 1765, a young mechanic named James Watt was trying to repair a steam engine when he thought of a better way of making steam engines, and that invention kicked off the Industrial Revolution. By the turn of the century, people were building railroads. Railroads had two effects. One of them was that they needed coal for fuel, and the other is that they established a stable roadbed so that the coal could be transported over very large distances from where it was mined. The growth of urban centers created a demand for better illumination. Illumination essentially had not changed since antiquity. For a while, whale oil lamps were popular, and whaling became a major industry, but by the middle of the century, whales were getting scarce. Some kerosene was made from coal, but that was expensive. And in 1859, Edwin Drake, a retired railroad conductor, drilled the world's first successful oil well in northwestern Pennsylvania. I've learned since the book came out that there was a lively oil industry in Canada in the early 1850s, but that was not based on drilling. That was based on gathering oil at natural seepages. Drake was the first one to drill through rock and find oil in a well beneath it. At first, the oil was used principally for illumination and for lubrication, but in 1861, Nicholas Otto, a German entrepreneur, invented the world's first gasoline-burning internal combustion engine, the direct ancestor of the engines we use in our cars today. And soon, oil was in great demand for fuel, and oil wells were being drilled all over the world. Over the course of the past 150 years, we have evolved a civilization that is firmly rooted in the mathematically impossible promise of an endless supply of cheap oil. Now, we can no longer live on light from the sun. We are going to run out of oil. That's absolutely inevitable. The only question is when. This is a page from the website of BP. It used to be British Petroleum. They now claim it stands for Beyond Petroleum. The pie chart on the left shows where all the oil, proved reserves of oil in the world are to be found. And you can see two-thirds of it in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf. There are no other important players in the game. The whole story is the Middle East. The Middle East has 10 times as much as the former Soviet Union, 10 times as much as North America, 10 times as much as Africa, and so on. All these other places you hear about are trivial by comparison. Only the Persian Gulf really matters. On the right, there are bar charts showing worldwide proved reserves by decades, 1981, 1991, 2001. And the unit here is 1,000 million barrels. 1,000 million is a billion. So these are billions of barrels, and we have 1,000 of those, a little bit more than 1,000 of those. And so what the people in the industry say is, look, we have 1 trillion barrels of oil just sitting in the ground, we know where it is, and all we have to do is pump it out and use it. The world is using something on the order of 25 billion barrels of oil a year, so we have a 40-year supply. There's absolutely nothing to worry about. This is called the RP ratio, or reserves to production ratio in the oil industry. That, as I'll try to show you, is the wrong way of looking at it. In the 1950s, it was the United States, not the Middle East, that was the world's leading producer of oil, producer in the sense that the oil industry uses the term. And all much of our military and industrial might arose out of our giant oil industry, and all oil geologists believed that that would go on forever, with one exception. That exception was a geophysicist working for Shell Oil in Houston. His name was Marion King Hubbert. And Hubbert knew the history of oil discovery in the United States up to about here, up to 1950, and he knew that it had peaked in the 1930s and had been declining since then. And he said, look, in the end, when all the data are in, this will be a classic bell-shaped curve, which, as we can see now, it is. And he said there will be a second bell-shaped curve for production or extraction of oil. You have to discover it before you can extract it, so the extraction curve comes later than the discovery curve. There will be a second curve, and it will have the same area under the curve, because the area under the curve is the total amount of oil that nature has made for us. And if I know the rising part of the production curve, the historical part of the production curve, and I know the area under it, I can pretty well estimate where it's going to peak. And he estimated that, using a little bit of mathematics, that U.S. Oil production would peak around 1970 and decline forever after that. He was virtually laughed out of the profession for making such a ridiculous prediction. But now we can see what the results actually were. This is the kind of curve, the red is the kind of curve that Hubbert predicted, and the black points are the actual data points for oil extracted in the lower 48, and you can see that he was right with uncanny precision. And so the question arises now, what about the whole world? This is true just for the lower 48 United States onshore. Here, on the left, we have the same data that we saw before in the form of a bar chart, but this is plotted in a much more revealing way. This is given as a continuous curve. These are the worldwide proved reserves. In OPEC countries, OPEC is the oil-producing exporting countries, a cartel that tries to govern the world oil industry. And on the right is the history of oil discovery and the history of oil production. In this curve on the left, you can see that the proved reserves in the OPEC countries jumped by something between 300 and 400 billion barrels of oil in the late 1980s. If you look over here on the right at the discovery curve, where OPEC is showing green, you can see that in the late 1980s, there were no significant discoveries made in OPEC countries. This oil is not geological oil, this is political oil. What had actually happened was that OPEC changed its quota rules for how much oil each country could pump, based in part on how much it claimed to have in proved reserves, and the reserves appeared out of nowhere, like magic. Over on the right-hand curve, you can see that the historic curve of production, it's very spiky, very noisy, because it's plotted here year by year, but if you sort of fuzz your eyes a little bit, you can see that it too is a bell-shaped curve, and it peaked around 1960. That is, Hubbert's peak for worldwide oil discovery occurred more than four decades ago in its history. The production curve then declined and crossed over the production curve around 1980. So for the past 25 years, we have been pumping oil and using it faster than we've been discovering it. For any sensible person, that would mean that the reserves should have been declining, but this is exactly the same period. And we see that the reserves always increase, even before and after the step function jump, the reserves have increased. So these reserves reflect more what countries want to claim for their own political and economic purposes than anything that's happening in actual geological oil fields. In any case, this information here, the history of discovery and the history of production, is exactly the kind of information that Hubbert had for the lower 48 states when he made his predictions. So we should be able to use this to make predictions, and many geologists have done exactly that. Here's one example. This particular one happens to have been published in Scientific American 1998. The red curve here is exactly the same production curve that you saw on the previous slide. The lower curves down here are just partial contributions to the top one. And the prediction made by these people is this curve here. And it predicts that the peak will occur right about now. We don't know exactly what will happen when the so-called worldwide Hubbert's peak occurs. But we have done a few experiments. We've done a couple of dry runs. Back here in 1973, and then again in 1979, we had temporary shortages because the Middle East countries closed down the spigot, took advantage of the declining American supplies in 1973 because they were angry about the 1973 Israeli war, and in 1979 because of the revolution in Iran. What happened both times, the experiment is quite reproducible, what happened both times is immediately panic and despair for the future of our way of life and mile-long lines at gas stations. Those two cases, the problem, the shortages were short-lived and because they were artificial. When this peak occurs, it will not be short-lived and it will not be artificial. It will be forever. On the other hand, however, you have to be skeptical in evaluating a quantitative prediction of that kind. For one thing, for the crucial figure that they need to have, that is the area under the curve, the total amount of oil that nature ever made for us, that particular prediction used 1.8 trillion barrels. If you look at the data today, I would think, as I look at the data, that 2 trillion barrels would be a somewhat better estimate. That number does tend to increase with time, pushing the peak off into the future. It increases with time for a number of reasons. One of them is because new technology has the same effect as new discovery. It just makes more oil available to us. It changes the meaning of how much oil nature ever made for us. Secondly, when oil starts to get scarce, the increasing price makes it possible to invest more money in technology and get more oil out of the ground. More becomes available. And that certainly is happening right now. Anybody who reads the newspapers will know. And thirdly, the figures for worldwide oil reserves are an important component of making the estimate of how much oil there ever was, and those numbers, as we've seen, are very, very undependable. Nevertheless, the basic idea of the people who follow Hubbert is correct. The worldwide supply of oil, like any other natural resource, started at zero, rose to a maximum, where we start depleting the resource faster than we can develop new sources of it, and after that it declines forever. And that means that we will have a crisis not when we pump the last drop of oil out of the ground, but when we reach the maximum, which is very, very roughly around the halfway point, which makes it a lot closer than anybody would have imagined without that insight. Ken DeFaze was an associate of Hubbert at Shell Oil, later went into the academic world and became a professor at Princeton and wrote an earlier book on this same subject. And he said that he realized that Hubbert had been right and that the peak had been reached when in the spring of 1971 he read in the San Francisco Chronicle this single line: the Texas Railroad Commission announced 100% allowable for next month. Now, that obviously needs decoding for anybody who isn't in the oil industry. The Texas Railroad Commission was the quaint name of the cartel that governed the United States oil industry by manipulating the excess pumping capacity of Texas. When it announced 100% allowable, what it was saying was there is no longer any excess capacity, we're pumping flat out, and the Texas Railroad Commission had therefore lost control of the American oil market. Almost as soon as this happened, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, was formed with the conscious idea of doing for the world what the Texas Railroad Commission had done for the United States. And it has been controlling the oil industry worldwide ever since. I believe, and since I got into this business, that the announcement that would tell us that the worldwide Hubbert's peak has arrived would be when we're told that the Saudis had maxed out, because the Saudis had been using their excess pumping capacity to manipulate the world oil market in exactly the same way that the Texas Railroad Commission used the excess in Texas. Well, on February 24th, 2004, just 3 weeks after my book came out, a front page story in the New York Times said exactly that. The story was called "Forecast of Rising Oil Demand Challenges Tired Saudi Fields." near the beginning somewhere, it says, the country's oil fields now are in decline, prompting industry and government officials to raise serious questions about whether the kingdom will be able to satisfy the world's thirst for oil in coming years. This is a New York Times story, so of course it's very long, and it's written in a style in which each paragraph contradicts the previous paragraph. This is called balanced reporting. So much further along in the article, he writes, some economists are optimistic that if oil prices rise high enough, advanced recovery techniques will be applied, averting supply problems. But then he immediately takes it back, saying in the next line, but privately, some Saudi officials are less sanguine. I don't know whether someday we will look back and identify the 24th of February, 2004, as the day the oil age began to come to an end. We're much too close to the situation to be able to judge that, and numbers of data that we have to use are much too undependable, as I've tried to stress for you. But to people who were aware of the Hubbard's Peak predictions, this story was a chilling story indeed. All right, well, who needs oil? First of all, petroleum is the feedstock of our giant chemical industry. Commodities such as plastics and fabrics, pharmaceuticals, and especially agricultural chemicals are made from petroleum. There are 6.4 billion people living on Earth today, most of them reasonably well fed. That's the result of what was called the Green Revolution in the second half of the 20th century. The Green Revolution consisted in very large part of fertilizing land using petrochemicals. I do not think that we could sustain the population that we have today, much less what we expect to have in 50 years, without petrochemicals. Some oil is used in stationary power plants, but not very much, because it's easily substituted in that application by natural gas or coal. Many homes are heated with oil, of course, but by far the most important application of oil is in transportation, because it's virtually irreplaceable in that application. Cars, trucks, planes, ships, and many trains run on fuel made from oil. This gives you an idea of the order of magnitude of the problem. These data are from 1998, so these numbers have increased slightly since then, but it's still essentially right. The primary fossil fuels, oil, natural gas, and coal, have a total of about 10 terawatts. The unit of energy is a terawatt year. We're using up 10 terawatt years per year in fossil fuel, so the burn rate is 10 terawatts. 10 terawatts of fossil fuel, half of that is oil. Then there are a few other sources of energy. Total is 13 terawatts. The United States uses one-third of that. We have 5% of the world's population. We use about a quarter, actually. We use a quarter of the world's energy. Quads are quadrillion British thermal units, a unit you will not hear again in this talk. So the economists tell us that there's nothing to worry about, because when oil gets scarce, the price will go up, and at the higher price, something else will come along to replace it. Of course, the oil industry has never been governed by what the economists would call an efficient market, because it's always been controlled by cartels, first the Texas Railroad Commission and then OPEC. But when the Hubbard's Peak is reached, OPEC will lose control of the market, and the price mechanism will kick in with a vengeance. And so the question is, what else can replace the oil? The word oil refers not only to the light crude oil that we've been pumping up to now, but also to more so-called unconventional oils, that is, things that are called heavy oil or oil sands or tar sands. Heavy oil, crudely speaking, heavy oil is what's left behind in the oil fields when you pump out the light crude oil. And with more investment and more technology, you can generally squeeze a little more oil out of any field. But of course, the more you squeeze out, the heavier it gets. The oil sands of Alberta have now become profitable because of the high price of oil. They used to be called the tar sands of Alberta, but that didn't attract as much investment, so they're now called the oil sands of Alberta. These are being mined, and that's the operative word. These are solid deposits. This is not a liquid that you pump out of the ground. You have to mine 2 tons of ore, strip mining, 2 tons of ore, to produce 1 barrel of a stuff called bitumen. And the bitumen that comes out is not rich enough to distill into gasoline, so hydrogen must be added to it. And in order to add hydrogen to it, Alberta has now built some of the world's largest plants for extracting hydrogen from methane. So that means that it's not only more expensive in money to get the fuel from that source, it's more expensive in energy. You're using fossil fuel, methane, natural gas is fossil fuel. You're using fossil fuel to make fossil fuel. And as you go down through the list of various hydrocarbons, that becomes increasingly true. Natural gas itself is a very good substitute for oil. You can make it chemically into gasoline, or you can run cars and compress natural gas. And so you could imagine converting to a natural gas economy. But the worldwide hub and spoke for natural gas discovery occurred in the middle 1970s. The worldwide hub and spoke for natural gas production is behind that for oil by only a decade or two. So at best, it's a bridging or temporary solution. Oil was created when source rock, rich in organic inclusions, sank to the bottom of ancient seas and then got buried within the earth. The interior of the earth is hot. It's heated by natural radioactivity. It gets hotter as you go down. If the source rock sank just to the right level and stayed there for millions of years, oil was created. If it sank too far, it got overcooked and became natural gas, which may or may not escape, or may still be there to be found. If it didn't sink far enough, it never became oil. That's what shale oil is. It's not oil at all. It's called shale oil to attract investment, once again. It's unborn oil. It's possible to mine it, strip mine it, crush it, heat it in a retort, and produce a substance from which fuel can be made. Now, people who have looked into this very carefully, I'm not talking about academics, I'm talking about industrialists who have spent a great deal of money investigating shale oil, have come to the conclusion that it will never be better than break-even in energy, and so it really isn't worth the trouble. Methane hydride is a solid that looks like ice but burns if you ignite it. It's formed when methane and water come into contact at very high pressures and very low temperatures close to the freezing point of water. We know the stuff exists, but nobody has any idea of how much of it there is, where it is, and whether or how it could be mined successfully and used. And then finally, there is coal. We are told that there's enough coal in the ground to last for hundreds or maybe even thousands of years at the present rate of consumption. The very fact that the estimates of how much there is range over a factor of 10 from hundreds to thousands tells you immediately that nobody knows. But those estimates are relatively dependable compared to the second half of the sentence at the present rate of use. The largest deposits are in the United States, although there are very large deposits also in China and Russia. It is possible to liquefy coal and use it as a substitute for oil. The Germans did that on a large scale during World War II. But it's a very dirty fuel. It often comes with poisonous impurities, including mercury, arsenic, and sulfur. You know, we're told not to eat too much tuna fish and swordfish because these big predator fish accumulate mercury in their bodies. That mercury originates in coal-fired power plants, mostly in the United States. From the point of view of the greenhouse effect, coal is the worst possible fossil fuel because it's virtually all carbon. The other fossil fuels are at least partially burning hydrogen, and not only making carbon dioxide. If you're going to replace oil with coal, you have to mine the oil much, much faster than we're mining it now. If you remember the slide I showed you before, we use twice as much energy from oil as we do from coal. So if you're going to replace the oil, you have to mine it not only three times as fast, but much more than that, because the conversion process is inefficient. You get much more energy by burning the coal than you do by burning the liquid fuel that comes out after you've converted it. So you have to mine coal at least five times as fast as it's being mined today. This is coal mining on an absolutely unimaginable scale. But even that doesn't take into account the increasing population of the world and the fact that people in the poorer parts of the world want to be more like us and burn more energy. Just as a case in point, there are 1.3 billion people in China. I understand that now some 30% of them have driving licenses. Most urban Chinese claim that they expect to own a car of their own within 5 years. It's the fastest growing automobile market in the world. And then, of course, there's the Hubbard's Peak effect, which is just as valid for coal as it is for oil. That is to say, the crisis will come not when we mine the very last ton of coal, but rather when we reach the point where we are depleting the resource faster than we can develop new resources. In other words, when we reach the peak. So the numbers at the top, hundreds and maybe thousands of years, have to be divided by at least a factor of 10, maybe much more than a factor of 10. And it seems to me a pretty good bet that if we throw caution to the winds, don't worry about the greenhouse effect at all, and burn all the fossil fuel we can get our hands on to substitute for the missing oil, that we will start running out of all fossil fuels, coal included, within this century. So what does the future hold? First of all, there will be an oil crisis very soon. I don't know whether very soon means that it's already begun, as the headlines in the newspapers every day tell us that, that the worldwide system of production and distribution of oil is stretched to the breaking point, and that is certainly a symptom that you would expect if we had reached the peak. But again, as I say, we're much too close to the situation, we can't tell. It might be happening already. It might not happen until later in this decade. It might not happen until the next decade. The difference is very important to us because we would like to go on enjoying the comfortable life that we lead, but on the scale of human history, 5 or 10 or 20 years absolutely is trivial. If we manage to muddle through and turn to the other fossil fuels and burn them instead of the oil, then all fossil fuels will start running out by the end of this century, very likely. Doing that has consequences for the climate that we cannot predict, as I've explained earlier. And once we reach that point, civilization can survive only if we can find other sources of energy. The physics tells us that there are only two other sources of energy, sunlight and nuclear energy. Switching to a civilization based on those sources of energy poses dilemmas that are absolutely enormous. They are primarily social and political. We are in the midst of a presidential race in the United States right now. This is the most important problem of our times. You have not heard either side say a word about this. And there are also technical problems. I can't say very much about the social and political problems, but I can tell you a little bit about the technical problems. What possible fixes can there be for the greenhouse effect problem? Well, one suggestion that has been made is to put a giant parasol at the Lagrange point L1. The Lagrange point is a point about a tenth of the way from the center of the Earth to the center of the Sun, where a body could stay in a stable orbit with a period of one Earth year. The Genesis spacecraft just came back from a few years at L1, so we know we can do it. And the suggestion is that if you put a parasol 1,200 miles diameter at L1, it would look from the Earth like a permanent spot on the face of the Sun. It would reduce the flux of sunlight by 2% and allow us to burn fossil fuel to our heart's content without worrying about global warming. Well, it might be possible to do that, but it's obviously a very foolish idea. As we've already seen, the destiny of the Earth is not fixed by the solar flux. With the same solar flux, it could be a frozen wasteland or a Venusian inferno. The last thing in the world, a future energy-starved world, is going to need is a permanent spot on the face of the Sun. The other thing that people talk about is sequestering carbon dioxide. How exactly you're going to extract carbon dioxide from emissions from various things that burn fossil fuel is not so obvious, but an even bigger problem is where to put the stuff. In order to have any serious dent in the problem, in order to make a dent in the problem, you'd have to put away the equivalent of a few ten-thousandths of the atmosphere of the entire planet. That's just a hell of a lot of gas to put somewhere. Carbon dioxide is being pumped into oil and gas wells successfully. It helps push out the oil and gas and stays behind. So that's good, but the volume available in those places is trivial compared to what's needed. People talk about pumping carbon dioxide into saltwater aquifers, but nobody knows whether that would work, whether the carbon dioxide would remain there or escape and so on. Another possibility is to pump the carbon dioxide into the deep oceans. At a temperature and pressure of the deep oceans, carbon dioxide becomes a liquid denser than water, so it would sink to the bottom. And since most of the planet is covered with ocean, there would be plenty of room, especially in that compact form, to put the carbon dioxide away. However, it would also dissolve in the ocean and change the acidity of the ocean and have a big effect on the ecology of the ocean that's unpredictable. In fact, even the fact that we've increased the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by 30% has already started to change the acidity of the ocean, and people worry about that. What about solar energy? Well, we already actually use quite a lot of solar energy in the form of hydroelectric power. The enormous pressure of water at the bottom of a reservoir turns a turbine, which generates electricity. The water comes out at the bottom. The sun makes it evaporate and rings back into the watershed and it winds up back in the reservoir. So that's a form of solar energy. About 25% of the world's electricity is generated by hydroelectric power. The problem is that we've already dammed up all the rivers we can, and so we can't make more hydroelectric power to replace the missing oil. Wind is becoming increasingly popular. The technology of wind turbines has improved dramatically, and tax breaks have made wind turbines almost economically competitive with coal-fired power plants. So wind farms are springing up in many places. But wind has a number of fatal flaws. One of them is its intermittency. The wind just doesn't blow all the time. You can't depend on it. And the other is its relatively low power density. You have to have tremendous wind farms to produce enough electricity for any reasonable size city. So wind will be a contributor to the energy picture in the future, but it will not save us. We may inherit the wind, but it's not going to solve our problems. Biomass. Biomass means basically you grow something and burn it. That's the way the human race lived until 1800. And there are many plans for the use of biomass. We already use biomass for one fuel, ethanol from corn, but that's a political fuel, not a reasonable source of energy. It actually is energy negative. It costs more fossil fuel to make the ethanol than the ethanol replaces. The principal problem with biomass is that in most cases the efficiency of the biomass is very low. Only one or two tenths of a percent of the sunlight falling on the land gets converted into chemical energy by biomass. The gold standard for solar energy is photovoltaics, that is to say solar cells. The standard of silicon solar cells, 10% efficiency, which is what we have now. You can make more efficient solar cells, but they're much more expensive. You can make cheaper solar cells, but they're much less efficient. So the gold standard is silicon solar cells, semiconductors. In order to, just as a benchmark figure, just have a number that we can understand, in order to generate the 10 terawatts of energy, of power that we use now in burning fossil fuels, in order to replace those 10 terawatts, you would have to cover 220,000 square kilometers with a silicon, 10% efficient silicon photovoltaics. 220,000 square kilometers is roughly half the size of the state of California. And that sounds like a lot of area, but the area is not important. There are lots of unused land in the world. The problem is that all the photovoltaics made in the world up to today probably wouldn't cover 10 square kilometers. So covering 220,000 square kilometers is a technical challenge of huge proportions. Not impossible, not unthinkable, but extremely difficult. On the other hand, to look at it in a more optimistic way, we are awash in sunlight. The total solar flux that we receive from the sun is 20,000 times those 10 terawatts. So the energy is there. It's not as if we lack solar energy. We just haven't begun to figure out how to use it yet. What about conservation? There's an article just in the past couple of weeks in Fortune magazine by Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute, and he likes to point out that conservation doesn't necessarily mean doing without. It could mean just being more efficient. So that if you make cars and planes out of the ultralight, ultra-strong materials that have been developed in recent years, you can save a lot of fuel that way. Hybrids are a technology that has now made it onto the road. I've been driving personally a hybrid for years. And it is more efficient. It cuts your use of gasoline in half. The buildings and factories that we have can be much more efficient. There are forms of biomass that are more efficient than others. Levin's names switchgrass and poplar. I would add sugarcane to that list because many people have written to me about sugarcane since the book came out. We can make more efficient use of electricity. We can have what Levin calls fee base, in which you charge a fee to the people who drive gas guzzlers and take that money and use it as a rebate for people who buy efficient, lightweight cars. That's the kind of social engineering that our politicians, by and large, are not willing to engage in, and so on. So conservation or energy efficiency has got to play some role, an important role, in solving our problems. What about nuclear energy? Well, geothermal energy is actually a form of nuclear energy because the geothermal energy is a consequence of the decay of natural radioactive uranium and thorium inside of the Earth. And geothermal energy is used in some places for space heating. Using it for power is much more difficult. There are only a few places on Earth where a geothermal source arrives close enough to the surface to be used for generating power. And when power plants have been built, and they have been built, it's found that after a few years you exhaust the heat and the earth doesn't replace it fast enough. So geothermal will always be a part of the energy equation, but never a major player. Nuclear fission is the kind of nuclear technology that we understand very well. People are afraid of nuclear energy. We haven't built any nuclear plants in this country for many years. Nevertheless, when the crisis comes and the need is strong enough, those fears may be overcome. However, using nuclear fission plants of the kind that we build in the United States today is not going to solve our problem. For one thing, the biggest plant you can build is about a gigawatt, and in order to make those 10 terawatts that we spoke of before, you would have to build 10,000 of the biggest nuclear plants you could build. That is a staggering number. It's not impossible, not unthinkable, but certainly a very impressive number. And if you did that and used them to burn the isotope U-235, which is what all American nuclear power plants burn, you would use up the known reserves of uranium in 10 to 20 years. So this is not the solution of our problem. Nuclear fusion might be a much better solution to the problem. The trouble with nuclear fusion is that it's been 25 years away for the past 50 years, and it's still 25 years away. It has been said both of nuclear fusion and of shale oil that they are the energy sources of the future and always will be. On the other hand, again, looking at it more optimistically, if you were able to burn a nuclear fusion, just deuterium from seawater, the energy available in a gallon of seawater would replace 300 gallons of gasoline. So if you could conquer the problem of nuclear fusion, you really do solve the fuel problem essentially forever. So it's the best hope for the long-range future. However, even if you were able to do that and have more power than you knew what to do with available in stationary sources, you would not have solved the problem with transportation, because there are not going to be nuclear cars or solar cars anytime soon. However, if you had the power available, you could solve the problem. You could use it to charge advanced batteries. The lithium-ion batteries that we use in today's cell phones and laptop computers have five times the energy density of the old-fashioned lead-acid batteries in cars. So advanced batteries are a real possibility. You could use it to generate hydrogen. Our president and our governor have launched us on a hydrogen economy, but that's a fool's errand. Today, hydrogen is made from fossil fuel and it takes the equivalent of 3 to 6 gallons of gasoline to make enough hydrogen to replace 1 gallon of gasoline. But in some future time, when we can generate unlimited amounts of power, say, from nuclear fusion, then making hydrogen might be a good idea. The hydrogen could be used either in hydrogen fuel cells, which are today very expensive and difficult, or in hydrogen internal combustion engines, which today is a much more advanced technology. Or you could combine the hydrogen with carbon dioxide to make a liquid fuel that would be carbon neutral. It would just be recycling carbon dioxide instead of creating new carbon dioxide. So any of those are possible. The point is that we understand the basic scientific principles that would make it possible to have a civilization running without the use of fossil fuels. We need to do it. This is supposedly a satellite photograph of the United States during the great northeastern blackout on 14 August 2003. And you can see a big chunk of the northeast here is missing. This is probably a fake. Probably somebody just took a satellite picture and covered up that part of the northeast. But it doesn't really matter. It serves to remind us just how fragile our civilization is. When that much of the country just collapsed because of a minor accident somewhere in Ohio. I'm a scientist, and a scientist is supposed to make predictions. That is to say, you're supposed to take your analysis and use the analysis to predict things. And the predictions test the analysis. If the analysis is correct, the prediction should be correct. I'm going to make a prediction, and of course you assume that simply making the prediction does not change the phenomenon. I'm going to make a prediction of a quite different kind. My prediction is that civilization as we know it will come to an end sometime in this century when the fuel runs out. I certainly hope my prediction will be wrong, and I hope that simply making the prediction will help to make it wrong. I would like to end this evening on a slightly more optimistic note. So I'll point out that there are projects to study solutions to this problem, that is to say, energy-related research, going on probably at every research university in the country. I can tell you what's going on, a little bit about what's going on at Caltech. And on fusion research, Paul Bellin and his group in applied physics are working on a device called a Spheromac. And a Spheromac takes a complicated combination of electric and magnetic fields and charged gases called a plasma, and they interact with each other. The fields push the plasma around, the plasma creates new fields, and the whole thing organizes itself into a jet, and then the jet develops a kink here, and that kink breaks off in the form of a donut. And that donut is the ideal configuration for sustained thermonuclear fusion, if you could sustain the donut, if you could keep it going. What Paul is doing with his group is not building reactors for power, but rather studying the basic physics of why it self-organizes in this way. And that's, of course, an essential step if we're ever going to use this particular type of device for generating power. I know of at least five or six different schemes for producing power from nuclear fusion. There's another group on campus called Powering the Planet. It includes Harry Atwater, Harry Gray, Cecina Halley, Nate Lewis, and Jonas Peters. It's largely focused on making use of solar energy in various ways. You may be aware that earlier this year, our provost, Steve Koonin, stepped down to become chief scientist at BP, which is one of the most important energy jobs in the world, and also explains where I got all those nice graphics from. When I became aware of this problem and really worried about it, very seriously worried about it, a few years ago, I asked myself, what could I do to help? That is, I'm just a physicist, an experimental physicist. I don't have any of the high-level skills that these people here have. So what contribution could I possibly make? And I thought about it, and I realized that the answer to the question was, what I could do is to write a book. And so I've written the book, and that's what brings us here tonight, and I thank you very much.